administrative building codes. We echo the comments of the committee administrator and Don. This is an oversight, and there isn't a fiscal because we didn't anticipate receiving the money. Basically, it would require us to relicense a dealer in about 6 months that's already licensed by DMV, and that doesn't seem to make much sense. Also wanted to bring to your attention, Don Miner with Manufactured Housing and I are working on a series of little technical fixes to what was Senate Bill 468 last session. And this was one of the things we agreed upon. We'll be putting that in House Bill 2389, I think it is. And that'll hopefully come back before your committee in another week or so. So you might see the same issue again.
2389, do we have that now?
You have it now, Mr. Chair, and it would be a replacement amendment for that bill. Deal with a couple technical fixes in this issue as well. As a package.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank
Great.
You, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2579? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2579. Open a work session on House Bill 2579. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2579.
Representative Kitts moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2579. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2579 to the floor with the due as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2579 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. He still votes aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries.
Consent calendar?
Consent calendar. Representative Kitts moves that House Bill 2579 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, on the consent calendar. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2008. Janet, give us a... summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for this bill as well, you should be looking at the dash one amendments. They do not replace the bill, but they do make some changes to the bill. With the dash one amendments, House Bill 2008 exempts prefabricated residential structures that are intended for delivery in another state from certain construction requirements imposed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It allows electrical and plumbing installation and prefabricated structures intended for delivery to another state to be performed by persons that are not licensed as electricians or certified as plumbers. It requires the director of DCBS to report biennially to the legislature on information supplied by the manufactured housing industry regarding manufacture of these prefabricated structures that are intended for delivery to other states. Mr. Chair, again, these are modular homes and not manufactured structures. And this would, because manufactured homes are subject to federal standards and are not subject to Oregon regulations, while modular homes are factory-built structures that are subject to state regulations. This is intended to create additional jobs for the modular home industry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Don Miner and Steve Leadham.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Don.
Members of the committee. For your record again, Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of House Bill 2008 with the dash one amendment. I want to begin by thanking you for hearing this bill, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2008 is a jobs bill. It will allow the manufactured housing industry to create new jobs where none exist today. We hope to do this by incorporating the construction of modular homes along with the building of manufacturing homes. We want to do it on the same assembly line. It does this by allowing manufacturers to build modular homes in Oregon to the building code and requirements of the state where the homes will actually be placed, rather than to the state of Oregon standards. If the homes are placed in Oregon, they'd be required to meet state of Oregon standards. We know of no opposition to this measure. Just before I get too far along, I'd like to give a couple of definitions. A manufactured home is a single-family home built in a factory to federal building standards. What we call a modular home in discussing this bill is defined in Oregon law as a prefabricated structure. That would be a single-family home built in a factory to state of Oregon requirements. Today, Oregon is home to about 10 manufacturers producing manufactured homes. We're the 10th largest producer of manufactured homes in the United States. 60% of everything built in the state is delivered to another state. I'm giving you a graph that looks like this. Essentially, it shows business activity. It shows wages and compared to homes built. Our high point year was 1998. We built about 12,000 manufactured homes in the state. Last year, we built, looks like, about 8,000. There's been a substantial fall off in business activity. In that same period of time, our annual payroll went from about $102 million to $67 million. So what we're doing is looking for some more business activity to strengthen our factories. I've given you a sheet that outlines, that's a survey we've done of our members. It looks at wages paid by the manufacturers. These are family wage jobs with benefits. The average manufacturer pays about $33,000 to an assembly line worker, a factory worker. No one has successfully built modular residential buildings in this state since the 1970s. I think Boise Cascade was the last person to do that. Our manufacturers do not believe it is possible to build modular homes and manufactured homes on the same assembly line if they're built to the state of Oregon requirements. Silvercrest Industries had a factory in Woodburn, Oregon. They were the most recent factory to try this. They built one of them, and it just couldn't be made to work. And they closed that factory and are now operating in California. The reason for this doesn't have much to do with the building standards themselves, the 2x4s, the wire, or things such that. It's more the process. It's the way the plan review process works. It's the requirement of journeyman labor in the factory. It's the requirement of the cover inspection. Those processes, just the way Oregon regulates it, contemplate site-built construction rather than assembly line construction. Again, we just haven't been able to make it work. The state of Idaho has a modular building code somewhat like Oregon's. Didn't work over there very well either. So in 2004, their legislature passed a bill similar to House Bill 2008, and they exempt modular homes built in that state for export to another state from the Idaho requirements. Now, if the home is going to land in Idaho, then you would have to meet Idaho requirements, just as this bill requires. So if one of these homes is going to come to Oregon, it will still have to meet the Oregon requirements. The Idaho manufacturers now are able to compete with site builders and modular home builders in other states. I gave you a picture. It's a photocopy of homes that they're building now in Boise, Idaho, and delivering to San Jose, California. Their products are so well accepted that they're beginning to compete with our manufactured homes, and so that we see Oregon manufactured home producers losing business to modular homes built in Idaho. And the Oregon manufacturers want to just simply be able to compete with those folks. The question of whether modular homes built in Oregon for delivery to another state, whether or not those homes had to meet the Oregon requirements, came up when Mr. Leadham's company, Champion, had an opportunity to bid on a contract to build homes for Fort Lewis, Washington, for service personnel and their families. It's about a $100 million contract. So we did some research, and the answer was kind of cloudy. And of course, they needed certainty. It turned out we didn't have to decide that question under state law, because they were federal homes or going to be owned by the federal government on a federal reservation, federal preemption prevailed, and so the homes were exempted because of that. But they can only build those homes if they're going to go to Fort Lewis without a change in law. At least that's our belief. Now, we're surprised this is even an issue when you think about it. The Oregon Building Code is designed to protect Oregonians. The purpose of the plumbing code, purpose of the electrical code, are to protect our plumbing systems, our electrical systems, etc. And by definition, these homes are never going to be connected in Oregon. In fact, the only Oregonians that will ever encounter these homes are the production employees and those transporting the homes out of state. Seems like there are two choices here. One is to require that a home be built to the state where it will actually be used. Homes being built in Idaho coming to Oregon, the state of Oregon is going to require that they be built to Oregon standards. The other choice is to require that they be built to the state where the homes are built, notwithstanding where they'll be used. The net impact of that, though, is to require that the home be built to the requirements of both states. And the state we're looking at is the state of California. California doesn't have an agreement with Oregon to accept Oregon's building code, so we'd have to be building the homes to, or we'd have to build the homes to the standards of both states, and this will simply make them non-competitive. The Idaho code turns out to be not quite as efficient as the federal building standards in terms of process, but it can be made to work, and we believe that we could build modular homes in Oregon to the California requirements and mix them in with manufactured homes. We do need the Dash 1 amendments. They add a requirement that the industry report back to future legislatures, I believe until 2014. I have that date correct. The industry is more than willing to do that. We had hoped to have Forrest Barnes. He's the general manager of Palm Harbor Homes. They have a factory down in Millersburg. I gave you a copy of his written testimony. Attached to that, just without reading his testimony, what he would have said had he been here is that he's lost about 100 production employees since 1998. He has capacity to build far more homes than he's building today. That his Palm Harbor has factories around the United States, and in all of those factories, except for their Oregon facility, they are allowed to build both modular homes and manufactured homes on the same assembly line. Attached to his testimony is a picture of some of the homes they're building in Arizona for delivery into California. He'd just simply like to build those homes in Oregon for delivery to California. With that, I will conclude my remarks and be happy to answer any questions, or you might want to wait until Mr. Needham has spoken.
Steve, you want to give your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Steve Leadham. I'm a resident of Silverton, Oregon, where I'm currently the plant general manager of the Champion Homes of Oregon Silverton facility. We currently employ 270 people and will be adding, hopefully very soon, an additional 80 people to help us with our Fort Lewis project. Champion Homes of Oregon is a division of Champion Enterprises, one of the nation's largest builders of single-family housing, and is currently the largest builder of modular housing in the nation. Just as a way of giving you some history background, over the last 5 years, Champion has been forced to close down three manufacturing facilities in the Northwest. As Don alluded to, one of those is in Woodburn, Oregon. The closure of that facility cost the state of Oregon 250 jobs. And it's important to note that those jobs are not minimum wage jobs. This is commonly accepted norm, and it's not. It's we currently at our facility have a pay range of between $11.50 and $16 an hour. We have full insurance benefits, including medical, dental, vision care. We offer short-term disability and even long-term life insurance. And all of our employees participate in a company-sponsored 401 program. A year ago, the Silverton facility was running at a production rate and an employment rate at almost a 20-year low. We were running at about a third of our capacity, and even at that, we were experiencing quite a number of down days due to lack of orders. You can imagine what chaos has created for our employees and the amount of instability that is surrounding the facility. At that time, we were approached by Fort Lewis, Washington, and asked if we'd be interested in building IRC coded International Residential Code modular housing for the base and for military families. Back in 1996, then President Clinton signed into law a defense authorization bill known now as the Military Housing Privatization Initiative, which provided for each of the services, giving them alternative authority for construction of housing on the military bases. Under the Army's Residential Community Initiative, the Army established a long-term business relationship with private industries to provide housing for the bases. And this is happening nationally. The pictures that I've got in front of you up there will show you a prototype house we built last summer to showcase what we can do with modular housing. And that's one model of five models that we'll be building for the fort. In the fall of 2004, we were awarded the contract, and these homes that you'll again see in the pictures are for enlisted married personnel. The first phase of this project of 67 buildings will provide housing for 174 families. And again, that's the first phase of five phases that will last over the next 3 years. And that's just one neighborhood. We're talking now about two additional neighborhoods that tack on the back of that project. In the first 6 months, the project will generate over $18 million in revenue. And over the life of the project, we anticipate that it will be close to $100 million. Most of those dollars will either stay in or come back to the state of Oregon. Why, you might ask yourself, why modular housing? The Fort Lewis started their housing project at a conventional site-built program. The program was to take over 10 years, and it was projected after the first 2 years to be close to $70 million over the course of the project, over budget. By using modular housing, we'll bring that budget back into line, and we'll complete the first phase of that project in a fraction of the time. So what will modular housing do for Champion Homes of Oregon? I said earlier we're looking to hire an additional 80 people, and we've already probably brought in the neighborhood of 50 people to supplement our workforce. It'll keep us at full employment year-round for the next 3 years and probably many years after that. If we had not been able to build these homes, they were going to proceed with the modular housing regardless, and they would have bought those homes from either Idaho or California and shipped them up here. The Oregon law governing the building of modular housing, it does not work on a manufactured production line. It's far too restrictive and cumbersome to make the process work. As I stated earlier, Champion Enterprises, the parent company of Champion Homes of Oregon, is one of the largest builders in the United States, and with sales well in excess of $1 billion. And we'll build 23,000 individual housing units this year. In every plant across the nation, with the exception of the Oregon plant, every one of those plants is currently building modular housing, and they're infusing that in their production line with their HUD-coded homes. We believe that this bill will create not only jobs for us, which we've already demonstrated it has, but it'll be a real shot in the arm for the entire industry. That's the end of my testimony. I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Neil. Any questions, Representative Schaffler?
Thank you. I supported the original bill. This one had there's a committee bill. That, and I will be supporting it today. My questions are, some people have voiced concerns about these products somehow ending up in Oregon. I guess I have three questions. One, they'll be built to the standards of where the communities are being put in, and I believe that's correct. Two, people have voiced concern about somehow them ending up in Oregon. These aren't small commodity you can run around. I'm not too concerned about that, but I want you on record saying that's not going to happen. And my third one has to do with the labor force. You said they get health care and dental, and that's good. Do their families get that, too?
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
I read very highly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also, you know, support this bill in concept, but I'm afraid I may have to vote no on this bill. as it is. And I'll tell you why I agree that, you know, the industry should be building to the state of delivery requirements. But I'm not sure, I really question the need to use unlicensed electricians and plumbers to meet those out-of-state requirements. I would think that using licensed plumbers and electricians would help make sure that those out-of-state requirements are met and that standards are upheld, because I think most other states also have require some sort of plumbing and electrical requirements. So I don't know, maybe you can change my mind on that by answering that issue for me. I'm just having a hard time with that one.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I can answer this, in a site-built environment where you bring in a electrical contractor, the individual, the knowledge base required of the individual is much more extensive than what we require on a manufactured housing or modular housing plant. And the reason for that is, in a site-built construction project, this individual is coming in and designing a system and installing every aspect of that system. And there's having just wired my own personal home, I understand how difficult that is and what is required of that. In our process, we're engineering that system for the folks on the production line. We're telling them where those circuits are going to be. We're telling them how to run those circuits. And we're engineering that into the process. And in our process, an individual may do nothing but wire panel boxes. An individual may be doing nothing but running wires. An individual may be doing nothing but adding or installing fixtures. The knowledge base for each one of those jobs is so defined and so regulated within our manufacturing plant that the broad knowledge of the code and the process is not necessary. And there's a very extensive internal inspection process that we go through. We also have regulated by HUD and by the state of Oregon, and those, every process of that electrical system is being inspected over and over and over again, making sure that it's in compliance. So again, we just break it. We engineer it into the product, and we break it down to such an extent that this doesn't require what's necessary in a site-built process.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask Don Miner for your record, the manufactured housing industry builds. In Oregon, has built hundreds of thousands of these homes, and they perform. It's also my understanding that the state of California does not require plumbers or electricians to do that work in their state. In terms of Mr. Schaffler's question, or Representative Schaffler's question, each one of these homes is identified by an identification number. If it's a manufactured home, it's a red identification number. If it's a modular home, I believe it's a gold identification number. That house can't be placed within the state, manufactured or modular, without first showing that it's complied with the building code's requirements. So I don't believe that there's much risk of these homes coming in to the state without meeting the Oregon requirements.
As they're constructing these, do they go through an inspection process of any kind there? By building codes people or any of the regulating agencies
on the production line?
Yes,
absolutely. No, we have five full-time inspectors that work for Champion. We have anywhere between two and three state inspectors at any one time inspecting the process, and then all that's being overseen by the federal government, making sure that on an annual basis and review that makes sure that everything's in compliance.
Although, Mr. Chairman, the modular homes contemplated under this code will be the inspection process will be regulated by the state where they're going to be delivered to. So they will decide how they're inspected.
And so they'll have to have inspectors on site there then?
They will either have their own personnel from their individual state, or they can contract that out with a third party to do that work for them.
I see. Is there, in this industry, is there any history of electrical and plumbing problems by the consumer after they've purchased these buildings? Is there any kind of real nagging problems that have come back to you?
Mr. Chair, the federal government began regulating manufactured homes in June of 1976. Previous to that, there were problems with the older trailer houses, mobile homes. Not so much this state as in other states, but still within the state there were problems. My guess is there are still problems even in site-built homes today that have to be corrected. But it isn't a severe problem within our industry at all.
Representative Schoenfer.
Are you all going to be able to come back 2 years from now and tell the legislature that you've generated a lot more jobs?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's certainly our hope. We've spent a lot of time on this legislation, that if it goes unutilized, I'm not sure. Our goal is to use the law.
Okay. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mark?
Morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long with Building Codes. I just want to, I'll just take 2 minutes of your time to clarify what we're talking about here, and then I just have a couple comments on the record. You're really talking about two different products. Under the federal law for HUD homes, it's federal preemption. We don't set the standards in the state of Oregon. We only inspect to the federal standards. And under the HUD program, this file holder, if you will, the codes are set, whether you can use licensed folks or not, all that's carried out under the preemption. For a modular home, whether it's built in new factories or not, it follows all of our regular regulations. So if it lands in Oregon, we inspect it, we make sure there's licensed folks, we do permits, just like a site-built house that that you would build on a piece of property. This bill before you, House Bill 2008, clarifies that if it's shipped out of state, we won't regulate it. And we're comfortable with that as long as it doesn't land here in Oregon. We've made sure that there's provisions in here for that if it does come back around that we can regulate, put our gold label on there and go through all the processes. And then one more quick thing related to the amendments on this. The last part of the Dash 1 amendments require a report to be submitted to the legislature from DCBS. I just want to clarify that we're going to, and as part of the discussions with the manufactured housing industry and other, we'll simply get that information from the folks that use this bill. We will fluff it and buff it and get it in the right format that we can submit to the legislature, but we're not going to make any assertions as to the accuracy or the numbers of jobs and analyze and all the different things in there. We've already kind of talked about that. We'll get it in a format. We'll get it to you. And we've also agreed that we'll use our manufactured housing dollars to pay for the cost and to work on that report. So that concludes my comments. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Thank you. Any questions, Mark? Representative Holden.
Just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, is there any reason why these out-of-state requirements couldn't be met by using Oregon-licensed electricians and plumbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holden, yeah, the short answer is that they could. The predicament that I'm in as a regulator, I no more want the state of California determining what the standards are if they built it there. When it comes to Oregon, I'll determine those and we'll inspect it. And as a matter of fact, if it's built down there, we make sure it is plan reviewed and inspected and under our code, nor do I want California telling me what to do up here in Oregon. So again, if the product, I made it very clear to Don, we're either all the way out of this or we're all the way in. This bill puts us all the way out. So if it's shipped out of state, I don't really have any regulatory responsibility. Could they? You bet. But from a regulatory standpoint, I feel responsible to take care of Oregon citizens, and we've got measures in here to do that. So if it comes back in.
Follow, Mr. Chair. Follow up. And I really wasn't questioning the requirement aspect of it. It's just the simple fact of we usually require licensed plumbers and electrical workers to do the work of those crafts in this state, and my question is why cannot those licensed people still do this work to the requirements from another state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holden, they could. Just to put some perspective for the manufacturer, when you're building the HUD home over here, under the federal requirements,
you don't use licensed plumbers and electricians, and you go through a completely different inspection process than when you're building a site built or a prefabricated product. So I think, I don't want to speak for the manufacturer, I think from their standpoint, when they're moving some of these down the production line and then moving some of these down the production line, mixing their employees and whatnot, probably becomes a challenge for them. I think that's why this bill's here, is to clarify that particular situation. But they can speak to that.
Follow, Mr. Chair? One last time. So as far as the products that will be delivered in Oregon and stay in Oregon, those products will be required to use the licensed plumbers and electricians.
Mr. Chair,
except for the HUD.
That's exactly correct, Representative. If it's built under this and stays in Oregon, we inspect it, we put our label on it, we make sure that it meets all the state standards. The federal thing, we're a contract inspection agency for the federal government, we make sure it meets the federal standards.
Any other questions? Don't say anything. Thank you, Mark.
You bet.
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 2008? And then we'll close the work session, or the public hearing, and open a work session on House Bill 2008. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the -1 amendments into House Bill 2008.
Representative Kitts moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2008. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 2008 as amended to the floor with the pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2008 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, one comment.
Representative Schultz.
I will be voting for this, but I just want to give my friends in the manufactured home business a heads up. If the United Auto Workers are ever out organizing these production line workers, you can bet your last dollar I'll be out there right on the street with them. But I hope you do continue to provide people with health care. I think that's important. I want these jobs in Oregon. But I think there's a lot of concern. That's my main concern right there, is how these workers are treated, how they're compensated, and the benefits they get. And if anybody out there organize them, I'll be out there supporting them. I don't want to clarify that on the public record. Thank you.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to thank the industry working so diligently with DCBS and Mark Long to provide a jobs bill. Very rarely, it seems, in this body do we get to actually vote on a substantive jobs bill that we can say, as a result of our legislation passing here today, jobs will be created. And I think this is a great example of that. So I'm happy to vote for it and thank everybody that brought this forward, because it gives me great pleasure to be able to campaign on certain things like this and go out there and talk to my voters and say, this is what I did. I created jobs for you. So thank you.
I'd like to add my voice to what Representative Kitts has said. These are homes that will be delivered out of state, so it has no absolutely zero impact on the home construction industry here as far as employment level goes. It just adds additional jobs for building homes that are going to be directed and shipped out of the state of Oregon. And it's a very plus bill. Great bill. Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing none, Katie, we'll call the roll.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
No.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Chalker.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Chair Perkins.
Aye. Motion carries. Need a carrier on the floor. Representative Kitts, would you like to carry?
More than happy to.
Okay. Okay, Dennis, where are we at now? Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3074, and Janet, please give us a summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3074 would allow disabled workers that are employed under a temporary services contract with the state that are employed by a qualified rehabilitation facility to work more than 6 months a year in temporary service positions. You can see that if you're looking at the bill itself, Line 19, if you employ temporary employees for workload needs, they may not exceed an equivalent of a 6 calendar month in a 12-month period. This would add an exception for disabled individuals. Again, those statutes that are referred to are, one, the qualified rehabilitation facility, and two, that it's a temporary service contract. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that it does not change up above in line 12 and 13. If the temporary employee is meeting the same workload need over a long period of time in the same position, it does not change the 6 months. But if they're moving the temporary employee around from different positions all the time, then you can't exceed the 6 months. This was the result of an attorney general opinion that the state is considered one employer, and so that was the reason for the introduction of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Tim Carl? Is that, I can get it close. Debbie Milton, yeah. Evan Burrows, and Julie, and I can't read that last name, Rifle.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Carl. I'm executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We're a nonprofit association that represents organizations who are nonprofit and serve people with disabilities around the state, like Shangri-La in Newport and Salem, like Living Opportunities in Medford, like Pearl Buck in Eugene, like Tualatin Valley Workshops. They're all over the state, and they serve thousands of people with disabilities. This bill was introduced at our request to correct what we saw as an unintended consequence of a state law that restricted people with disabilities under contracts negotiated under the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. The Products of Disabled Individuals Law has been around since 1977. It now has 20 pages of administrative rules on how it operates. It's the most regulated law of its kind in the country, and it has a clear definition of disability and who can certify those disabilities. As the committee administrator said, when you hit the equivalent of 6 months' work or 1,040 hours in a 12-month period, you have to lose your state employment. We had been operating without that understanding for a few years, and in September of 2003, an attorney general opinion made it clear that those people needed to lose their jobs. Our solution, which we've discussed with Department of Human Services and Department of Administrative Services and with AFSCME and SEIU, is this bill, which would exempt just the individual, not the position, from that restriction for 1,040 hours. The bill does nothing else. We're not here to argue the merits of whether the state should use temporary services or not. This bill doesn't affect that. There's only a small number of people with disabilities that this actually affects. Our estimates are it would be about 200 people a year. While that may be a small number in the overall scheme of things, it's not to those individuals with disabilities. The bill is supported by the Developmental Disabilities Coalition of Oregon, which represents 25 organizations that serve people with disabilities, advocates, the ARC, the Developmental Disabilities Council, and others. With me is Debbie Melton, who's accounts manager for the Galt Foundation, and two individuals who have worked for Galt on temporary services contracts. And as a final note, I'd just like to point out that people with disabilities continue to have the highest unemployment rate of any population in the country, well over 65%, and that's been the case for 25 years or more. And I'll be happy to answer any questions or hold until the rest of our panel has testified.
Why don't we let the whole panel testify and then we'll have some questions.
Good morning, Chairperson Brown and committee members. I am Debbie Melton. I'm with the Galt Foundation. I'm testifying today to urge the committee support for House Bill 3074. Galt Foundation is a qualified rehabilitation facility, and we've been certified under the Products of Disabled Law, which is ORS 279.85 to 279.855. So in September 2000, we were awarded a state contract, and since then we've been working with state government offices. Since that time, we've placed nearly 1,000 people in state government positions. The majorities of our employees with disabilities come to us directly from state-funded vocational rehabilitation programs. So this program has been very effective in allowing these workers with disabilities find steady employment, often for the first time in their lives, and in many cases to acquire regular full-time employment, and after their stint as one of our temporary staff. It's definitely improved the lives of many of our employees and reduced or eliminated the dependence on state-funded services. I personally was involved with a survey where I called 20 of our current and former employees and went through a series of questions and asked them, you know, what was your livelihood before Galt and what's it been since Galt? And there wasn't one person that didn't answer yes to the fact that they were now not receiving food stamps, Oregon Health Plan, unemployment. The list really went on. And out of all 20 of those people, I did ask if they felt as if they would be working if it wouldn't have been for Galt, and only one of them said yes. So we feel confident in what we do every day, but that was really a nice affirmation, too. So please keep in mind that these positive outcomes have been achieved with absolutely no state funding. The result simply from the fact that the state purchases needed temporary services through the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. So in September 2003, as Tim mentioned, this rule went into effect that has limited our employees to working no more than 1,040 hours in the state as a whole in a consecutive 12-month period. This has made a major impact, and the majority of our employees have been faced with the prospect of working steadily for 6 months and then not working for 6 months, either going on unemployment or going back to state-funded programs. It also has made an impact in many of our staff members losing their medical benefits, and we also do provide vacation, sick leave, all of that dwindles away very quickly. So this restriction is contrary to the intent of the Products of Disabled Individuals Law, which states that it's supposed to be a constant market. And for this, it's just not working at all. So the employment, temporary employment, has proven to be an excellent vehicle for assisting individuals with disabilities to prove maximum employability. However, we cannot expect this to continue. If their employability is bound to only 1,040 hours in a year. We feel that HB 3074 is definitely a solution and can help assure continuing successful employment outcomes for our staff members. With me today is Evan Burrows, a former Galt employee, and Julie Rifle, who is a current employee. They'll present their stories, and basically both of these staff members were definitely certified disabled through us, and we're involved with state vocational rehabilitation program. So Evan, go ahead.
Thank you.
My name is Evan Burrows. I work for Oregon Department of Transportation as an associate transportation engineer survey analyst now, thanks to the training I was afforded through the Galt Foundation. I had an opportunity to work as a temporary employee for ODOT, going in with basic drafting skills and knowledge, but not a knowledge of the particular software that ODOT uses. In the 6 months time frame, I learned how to use the software effectively due to the structure of the timing of my employment relative to this bill. I was allowed to continue on for another 3 months until a permanent position came open. If I had not been able to do that 3 months additional time, by the time it came time to interview for that position and take the skills test, my expectation is that I would not have been able to compete successfully on that skills test. I entered the Department of Transportation survey group as an engineering specialist one just to get started with the program. I recently had the opportunity to move up to the associate transportation engineer position, or I should say compete for that position. I was a successful candidate based strictly on the skills. I competed with another member of my crew, and we both came through the interview portion dead even. The individual that I was able to out-compete on the test is a registered professional land surveyor who came out of ODOT's Region 1 area and had been away from the software tools for a period of 3 to 4 months as he was doing field work, and it made his skills rust enough he was unable to compete in the test. So from my point of view, my supervisor's point of view, by being able to work continuously until such time as a full-time position came open, it kept my skills up so that I could become a good taxpaying person, good union member.
God bless you.
Pay my dues. I can get out there and help out. And keep the production going through the OTIA projects and so on and so forth, where if I'd had to leave at 6 months, they'd have had to bring in another new person, zero skill level, and then they'd start going backwards in their ability to meet the needs of the citizens of the state. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at the end.
Thank you, Evan. Julie?
My name is Julie Rifle, and I'm a disabled person. Hello. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for a lot of people to speak in public, but I was told all I have to do is tell my story.
Could we move the mic over there in front of her?
This is my story. In 2003, I went to Galt, and they gave me a placement at DMV as a data entry clerk. I did that for 6 months. Then I was unemployed. There was an opening at DMV for the position, and I applied, and I was hired, but I was unable to make it through trial service. I cry a lot. It doesn't quite fit in. In 2004, I took a placement at ODOT on Mill Creek. The placement there was a temporary placement, and I was to work while they were replacing a person who was leaving. They hired a person, but because I was able to work hard, they found me other work at ODOT Mill Creek. And I really liked it there. The people were wonderful. But the 1040 rule was enforced. So I was without work once again in the fall of 2004. Galt kept me on their insurance rolls, so I was able to get my medicine and my medical treatment. In 2005, Galt placed me at DHS. This placement will end July 25th or sooner. Because I am a temporary, I'm just providing temporary service. So July 25th, I will again be unemployed. I'm sorry for my tears, but I think they're important because I was told that the people who make law need to meet the real people, and I need to make you feel my heart. This is all I can do to have you feel my heart, is to show you fear of being unemployed and gratitude to Galt because they have stood by me and they have kept me. I started as a data entry clerk and now I'm working as an administrative assistant. Thanks to Galt. I hope you will consider well our testimony. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Representative Schaffer?
Thank you. You know, this issue is the most painful issue that I'll face as a legislator, because I have folks on the one hand that need some flexibility in the hiring process so they can get a good job. And then on the other hand, I have my philosophy that anybody's doing the job, regardless of who they, what they look like, where they're from, what language they speak,
whether they have suffer from disability or not. They deserve to get the wages and benefits that anybody else is doing that job can do. Now, I couldn't do data entry or traffic analysis if you paid me. On the other hand, if I were in a wheelchair, I couldn't finish concrete. That's just life, and that's what life's brought to us. My whole thing about this, we have two competent people before us. They're up here on the top of the pyramid, and there's all kinds of other folks out there that, in my opinion, if they're doing the job, I don't care what they do look like, what their physical or mental abilities are, if they're doing it, they deserve the wages and benefits. If they can't do the job, then is that the most efficient use of our money? This is hard. This is very extremely difficult for me to deal with. And it's never going to get any easier. My whole thing, I don't care, once again, who you are, where you work for, who you work for, what you're doing, what you look like. If you're doing the job, you should get the wages and the benefits. And my fear about this is, we take the 6 months cap off. Now you got folks that, and this is a quote from someone who worked for DePaul Industries, you get workers with disabilities get hired as regular employees with government agencies. Well, if they're regular employees, they better be getting the wages and the benefits of their coworkers, period. And I think maybe six months isn't long enough. But you know what? I'm really afraid that people will take advantage of the very people that are here before me in order to save money. And, you know, I'm all for saving money. I'm all for being efficient. But I'm not in favor of taking advantage of workers. I'm not in favor of displacing long-term workers just so our government can save money on things that we need and demand in this state. Mike, forgive me for going on, Mr. Chair, but my question is, and maybe Mr. Krall or Ms. Rifle could answer this. There's been some concerns about the definition of disabled. And one of the first ones that comes up is alcohol and drug addiction. Some folks think that's a choice. Some people think it's a physical addiction. I think they've proven that it is. We are genetically inclined, some of us, to be addicted to drug and alcohol. Could you clarify what the definition of disabled is here in the state of Oregon?
Well, basically, we follow the American Disability Act. So that's the first level, and that's really what we follow. After that, for us personally, to come to us and work for us, it has to make an impact in your employability. So quite frankly, we have some people that have been deaf that we've sent off this form to their doctor, and their doctor won't sign it because they say it has not made an impact in their employability.
And that's what Representative Chopper and Chair Brown, that's what the state law says in the products of disabled individuals law. The definition of disability is that it represents a barrier to employment and that they need specialized employment opportunities under this law. So it isn't so much the whatever the setting event, whether you got hit by a train or hit by 20 years of alcohol abuse, if you've got brain damage as a result and it represents a barrier to employment as certified by a professional, that's the disability this law covers, and it's more strict than the Americans with Disabilities Act because that doesn't say anything about a barrier to employment. So the issue of are there people who have had substance abuse that are termed disabled by a professional that it represents a barrier to employment in this population? Yes, there are. Are there very many? No, there aren't. But there are some. I don't know if that is specific enough. There's the 20 pages of administrative rules I referred to have clear delineations of who can provide that definition, where it comes from, who can provide the certification.
Mr. Chair, just so I can clarify this too for the record, because I don't want anyone going out of here thinking anything different than what I'm trying to express. I absolutely and completely support flexibility in the law allowing for folks to get training so that they can get out and become productive members of the community. Voting record to prove it. Once again, though, if you're doing the work, sir, ma'am, you deserve the wages, you deserve the benefits. And I don't want anybody to be able to extend your employment time without those wages and benefits. And that's one thing. I'm not saying I'm voting no on this yet, but I'm very concerned about somebody allowing them to take advantage of you, the worker. But I do support the flexibility in the law to help folks with disabilities. I want to make that very clear.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions?
May I make a
certainly
comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
To reference Sheffield, the reason it took so long in my case to gain the permanent employment was due to the nature of the situation at ODOT at the particular time, due to some reorganizational issues and so forth. My supervisor and survey group manager wanted me as a permanent employee much more rapidly than we were able to achieve it due to the nature of the situation. So I came in filling in for somebody else, filling in for somebody out on family leave, and once that time frame expired, another employee left, creating an opportunity. That employee left in December, and it took until April, the end of April, to get through all the processing. So they wanted me there. They wanted me to pay, or wanted to pay me the wage. It just took a while to get all the people moved. So in my case, 6 months wasn't long enough. 9 months would have been right. In somebody else's case, due to the amount of people allowed to be employed by ODOT, the full-time positions, and so forth, it took a while to get the situation to where I could achieve the goal that you and I both wanted, which is full-time, full employment, good wage.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair, one more. You know, we do a lot of things in this building to keep the number of full-time employees down so it looks good with the public, and we call them limited duration employees, which that frustrates me to no end because they are full-time employees. Somehow, if we could dial something into this that says, after you work for the state for X amount of time, I don't care who you are or what you're doing. If you're doing the job, if you're on the job, you show up every day, you can do it. I don't care. You're going to be paid the wages and benefits of every other full-time employee. Once again, I think I am blind to this as far as what your background is, what your abilities are, who you are, all that. If you're doing the work, you should get the wages and benefits, period. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My original understanding about this bill, maybe you can help me clarify this, is that this would allow people to move from position to position but still be employed in the state. But as I'm looking at the language, line 20 to 23, it seems to allow for a person to stay in that job, that same job, for as long as they want, as long as they're employed by QRF. Am I misreading the language of the bill?
Let me do it. Basically, they will not be able to stay in one position for longer than 1,040 hours. Now, what we did before this law was Julie worked for us for DMV. They would come. We were already recognizing DMV. I mean, ODOT was already recognizing 1,040 hours. They would terminate her employment. Not a problem. You know, probably not the greatest thing for ODOT because they lost that seniority, her knowledge. But then we could just move her into another job, maybe at ODOT, but a different job. And so she still is a Galt employee, definitely not a state employee, in that we have many different places we can put people to work throughout state government. I mean, you know, between Department of Justice, the Department of Human Services, there's many, many positions available where there is employment that's needed through temporary venue because there is a short-term need. You know, it's a medical leave. They have a special project. And so we move our employees in and out of those positions. What's happened since then is the fact that they've pretty much been put out of work because we can't transfer them to different areas within state government.
Chair Brown, Representative Shields, our understanding is that it does not allow a position to extend. If that's not clear, we think it is. But and the only other point I wanted to make, Representative Shoffler, Galt does not prevent any of these people from applying for permanent positions. In fact, the temp services QRFs have gotten more people with disabilities employed in state work than any program because people got exposed to them, they trusted their abilities. So it has actually proved to be one of the best venues that we've ever encountered for getting people into state jobs. So Galt doesn't say you have to stay with us as a town. They, you know, if that happens, those people apply.
Mr.
Representative Shaw.
And just for the record, too, look, I understand how people work and think, I think. They see somebody in a wheelchair, they see somebody that stutters, they see somebody with a criminal record, and the way they don't dress that day. Any number of reasons give somebody the reason to say, I'm not hiring that person. And I understand that, and I sympathize with that, and I support flexibility in the law to get folks into a productive position completely. And I commend you and the work that you do. Once again, I'm going to say this again, and I'm going to keep hammering on this. I don't care who you work for, whether it's Galt or DePaul or anybody. If you're doing the job, you should get the benefits and the wages of everybody else getting the job, period.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll make sure that I understand. People are employees of Galt. So does Galt pay the employees and the state pays Galt for those services, just like any other temporary agency?
Primarily. Mm-hmm.
So do you, somebody gets hurt on the job, who takes care of that?
Galt.
Retirement?
We have a program available.
Mm-hmm. Unemployment?
Galt.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, why would a person who's working more than 6 months for the state, why wouldn't the state consider them a full-time employee instead of a temporary employee at that point?
Well, I think because of the fact that the need, what caused them to be there to start with. I see a lot of our placements due to the fact that people are on medical leaves, FMLA leaves. So, you know, there's really no need for to hire someone as a state employee when you've got that type of situation. The state's saving those positions for their people. You know, it's not really an open position. They still have a workload that needs to be met while some of their state employees are away from work. But now, you know, so that's why I see it.
Yeah, Chair Brown, Representative Holby, I think that's a part of the answer. The other is the restrictions that the state has on permanent employees, and they use temporary employees, whether the unions think they should or whether anybody thinks they should. They do have those contracts. If Galt wasn't providing them, Kelly or Manpower or some other company would be. It's simply because the state has a need, and they purchase this service. So I don't know how those decisions are made about whether the state uses temp services or, but yeah.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, I have to reiterate just a little bit what Representative Schaffler had to say. You know, we have a real issue here that is real tough, and I fully support integrating disabled people into our workforce. I fully support that. But it becomes a point at some point, there becomes a point that you have to start worrying about actually outsourcing a good share of your workers. And when a lot of your rehabilitative associations take commissions, I do believe on that's how the Oregon Rehabilitation Association gets paid. Collect commissions, I think. Is that true?
Chair Brown, Representative Hovey, yes. We, as a part of marketing the program, we have 3 staff full-time and about a quarter of my time that's dedicated to this program, and we fund it with commissions based on, actually it's called dues, but based on the work procured, and that amounts to about $225,000 a year on a net gross of over $40 million. So it comes out to about 0.6% or something. The federal program, for example, works on a straight 4% of gross. Other states that have staffed programs work on commission bases of 4 to 8%. We consider ourselves to be extremely lean and efficient at working at the percent that we work on overall. But yes, we do get commissions.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, in light of that, in this whole outsourcing issue, I think that it really doesn't serve the QRFs a great deal of service when they make statements like "focus on your best, outsource the rest," and statements that you can find on the DePaul Industries website. Because it just leads us to believe that your main goal is really to displace workers. Not really that you're trying to, underlying that is you're trying to put disabled people to work, which we all support, but at the expense of displacing, a lot of workers is really the issue that we have to struggle with, and trying to find that balance is very difficult, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Chairman Brown, may I?
Certainly.
Chairman Brown, Representative Shoffler, I hear, and Representative Foley, I hear a lot of concern about the wages being paid the disabled worker, the benefits, and so on and so forth. I can only use my case as an example. When I was working with Galt, I was getting a wage higher than what ODOT was willing to pay the full-time permanent person for that. I was getting benefits, sure, I wasn't part of the union, I wasn't part of PERS. But in this environment, that all works out. My supervisor had to go to HR and really beat on him to get me up to the level that I was getting paid working through Galt to work for ODOT, so that he was confident I would stay with him and continue to put the training to the benefit of the citizens. So I'm not sure that the outsourcing, the perceived low wage to those of us in the disabled community, the perceived using of the people in the disabled community is really that accurate. And particularly in the case of ODOT, we have to be very careful about the outsourcing issue, because the legislature has given us a huge pile of work to do and money to do it with no people to do it, and it all has to be outsourced. So it's another balancing act of a nature. So I hope that addresses your concern about the possibility of me being abused because of the wage issue.
One more follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe in your case that's true. I absolutely believe you. I have no reason to come here and tell me any different. And I would have gladly beat on that HR person for you.
Mm-hmm.
But there are examples where union workers have been, I don't care if they're union or not, displaced by this system. And I think even the quality of the work has suffered. All them janitors up in Portland,
yeah.
I think it's a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sir, you deserve your job. I support you, ma'am. I support you completely.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is a very, I hope you understand where we're coming from. It's very hard to deal with. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your patience.
Thank you. I certainly go ahead.
Okay. I'm feeling a little confused, and maybe somebody here can help, because my impression is that any business, any agency, at some point is going to need temporary help. If you have a person who gives their 2-week notice and you're required to spend 6 to 8 weeks to find a replacement for them, you need to have a temporary come in and do the work until you hire a permanent person. If you are required by law to only have so many employees, but you need to get the work done, you may have to hire a temporary to come in because there was more work than you anticipated when you originally did your budget. My impression of why we're here today is we're asking for consideration for a person who has disabilities to do that temporary work, to go in and learn new skills, how to deal with the real world maybe. So if I'm wrong, I'd like to know that. And I'm in the same situation as this gentleman. I've never been paid less than peers working in the same position. I've had the joy of helping somebody get through a rough spot. I'd like to have that joy a lot. I'd like to have it 12 months out of the year. And it doesn't need to be with the same agency, but for me it's that learning thing, being able to go in and learn new things. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
I think you've got it exactly right. I think you understand real well here, right on as far as I'm concerned. Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, I think the concern with my colleagues, and I'll try to speak formal, though they'll probably throw something at me here, is we don't want you to be a permanent temporary. People do abuse the system. Doesn't matter where they work, they abuse the system. If you had that temporary 6 weeks, and then they thought, well, you know, we're not paying the benefits that we would a permanent employee, let's march that on out and keep it going. That's the concern here. And the concern is for you, that you do not get in a position of where you are a permanent temporary employee. I think that's what our concern is.
Representative Chair Brown and Representative Esquivel. I think that Julie chooses to be with us because it's the best fit for her. And so, you know, and that's just what we want to do, is be able to keep people like her employed that choose to be with us, because it's hard for her to interview. She shared that with me. I have asked her why she hasn't gained employment in her laps, because she's actually been laid off with golf due to this 1,040 hour, been on unemployment, you know. And I said, well, why didn't you, have you tried to apply for some regular FTE jobs out there? And she said no. She's afraid. And she's afraid. So I think that this is a great fit for some people that just need that bridge. She may be one of those ones that is an ongoing temporary. We have some that come and go. And then we have some that come and then they leave and they're gone. They haven't come back. I've been working with Galt now for 4.5 years and I've seen all of the above. So
thank you, folks, for coming and testifying today. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Could I have Mary Watkins and Jesse Stevens? I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botta. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I'd like to start my testimony by reading you two things. I'd like you to understand first what the policy of the state of Oregon is when it comes to this workforce. The purpose of ORS 279.015 and 279.835 to 279.855 is to further the policy of this state to encourage and assist disabled individuals to achieve maximum personal independence through useful and productive gainful employment by assuring an expanded and constant market for sheltered workshop and activity center products and services, thereby enhancing their dignity and capacity for self-support and minimizing their dependency upon welfare and the need for costly institutionalization. Disabled workers are, a disabled individual means any individual who, because of the nature of their disability, is not able to participate fully in competitive employment and for whom specialized employment opportunities must be provided. These words were put into law with the support of the American labor movement and the Oregon labor movement. We supported these words for one reason and one reason only. About 10 years ago, we realized that the state of Oregon was crassly exploiting temporary workers. We had workers who had been temporary in nature for as long as 8 years, never having gained full-time benefits, never having gained any seniority, and never having gained any right to the job they had been doing. We put in a bill that as I said, about 10 years ago that said, the state of Oregon shall limit its services, its use of temporary employees to 6 months. After 6 months, those employees must be moved to what they call limited duration status. Once they're moved to limited duration status, the employer can keep them for as long as they want them. The difference is they get full benefits. They get retirement. They get seniority. They're protected by the union contract. It means they are no longer at-will employees, at the will and whim of whoever wants to throw them away. It is the position of our union that an integrated workforce must include people who are of different races, of different sexes, and of different abilities. It means that when we say we want an integrated workforce, we want a workforce that includes disabled individuals as full partners, not as temporary services, not working for somebody else, but working for the state of Oregon and for every other public employer in Oregon. We think you should set the standard. That the private sector should have to live up to the standards that you set for the disabled community. That means full employment, full access to employment, and it means full status as an employee, which means you gather and can accumulate seniority, you get retirement benefits, and you get full health care. This bill undoes that. It says we can keep you on as a temporary service employee for as long as we want you. And when we're tired of you, we'll just throw you away and somebody else, heaven help us, will pick you up. Maybe. You know, we protect older workers. We protect our disabled workers. What concerns me the most about this bill is the practice that it encourages. Because the practice that we have seen and that I have seen, both as a staff union, you know, as a staff rep for a unionized workforce, I watched one employer displace 75 janitors in one of our large employment facilities who came to work for that employer in the late 60s and early 70s under CETA. They displaced every one of those individuals after almost 20 years on the job and contracted them out. And they contracted them to people who looked just like them. That's not okay for me. What is okay for me is if we need temporary employees, and I admit we do at times, then after 6 months, move them to limited duration status and make them eligible for every other benefit that the employer has to offer. They don't need to work for Galt. And you know what? I don't need Galt. What I need is an employer who has an active non-discrimination policy, and I think the state of Oregon and this legislature is capable of doing that without paying a percentage off the top to get somebody to do it for you. Your unions and you as the employers can do this together. We don't need a third party telling us how to do what's right. You don't need this bill. What we need is a better way to manage what we ought to be doing. Thank you.
Any questions, Mary? Don't see any. Thank you, Mary, for your testimony. Is it Jessica?
Jessica's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
You'll tell me what it is.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, Jessica Stevens.
Jessica.
Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm here testifying on behalf of SEIU, and we represent both state employees, including those who work in the Vocational Rehabilitation Department, and also employees of private agencies who are people with disabilities. And today's unfortunate reality is that employers either don't have the resources, the support systems, or the will to hire more people with disabilities. So the state of Oregon has taken on the important responsibility of enabling employment for this population. And this is the right thing for Oregon to do. But as you've heard my colleague say, we should do so with fairness in the same way that we hire anybody else who's doing the same work. SEIU is certainly concerned about the ongoing elimination of family wage jobs in Oregon. And we're also concerned about opportunities for people with disabilities to obtain permanent employment. My understanding of the intent of this bill is to cover some specific jobs that were never done by state employees. For example, some agencies have the option of purchasing printer and toner cartridges that are assembled by people with disabilities. But the language in House Bill 3074 is too broad. The change in line 19 from shall to may makes the language too permissive, and lines 20 through 23 expand the intention of the bill to conditions that risk the elimination of those family wage jobs with health care. The distinction between position and the individual is not clear. And I just want to clarify that we would strongly support a limited duration temporary employment status for folks through this program. And that would mean that those folks would become bargaining unit members who would get paid the same for the same work and receive the same benefits as those folks working next to them doing the same jobs. From the perspective of our members who have disabilities, this language would actually make it more difficult for many to obtain permanent employment. Our society may be in the sad place of accepting that employers compensate people with disabilities at reduced wages and benefits, and maybe that is the necessary incremental step we must take to reach a place of fairness. But as the committee just discussed, family wage jobs are important to Oregon, and we shouldn't undo the committee's good work by putting more jobs at risk. This debate doesn't have to be a polarizing discussion. I think we agree with the intent of the original law, and we generally agree with the intent as we were described of this bill. But this language is too broad. We just heard a wonderful success story, particularly in the from the engineer in ODOT. And unfortunately, this language would actually not create more opportunities like that, but fewer. If the true goal is steady and permanent language, this steady and permanent employment, this language does not address that. I just would also like to add, one of the people on the panel before referred to Julie wanting to work for Galt, and that's her choice, and that they provide the support network that she receives. But I think we should ask Julie if she would like to get the same wages as someone working next to her and the same health care in addition to that support network. And I wager her answer might be yes.
Mr. Chair, and if I can add something, because I think Jessica brought up a really good point. Again, Mary Bodkin. I guess my question is, why isn't Galt providing some sort of interview coach so that Julie said she'd lost the job on interview, and Galt said she doesn't interview well. Well, you know what? I don't interview well. There are things that you can do, and especially with this community, there are ways to assist folks in getting through an interview process when they're not very good at it. And, you know, I would say that Galt's obligation would be to help Julie find a permanent full-time job in the state of Oregon or any other public employer. I think we have an obligation to help do that.
Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you
both for your testimony. And with that, committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3074. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3262. How do you pronounce that last name?
I think it's just Pepper.
Elizabeth Hawker. Was Want to come down and testify? Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Parker. I work for the Judicial Department, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 3262. First, I'd like to thank the committee for giving me this opportunity to testify. It's been my privilege to serve our country in the Air Force during the Vietnam War. Since that time, I've spent 28 years in public service in the state of Oregon. In 1997, Senate Bill 711 became the law that you have before you. The purpose of the law is to give the veterans the ability to buy back at full cost up to 4 years of military time when they decide to retire. When PERS figures retirement benefits, they're done under several methods, the full formula plus annuity, and money match. Under current rules that PERS uses, the retiree is given the highest monthly benefit that's figured. Unfortunately, in some cases, the highest monthly benefit can also be the highest dollar amount when you're buying back your time. The change to the ORS that I'm requesting would allow the veteran to decide under which method to retire, and they could choose a lower monthly benefit in order to get a lower buyback cost. I believe the legislators, when they originally passed this law, were trying to create a useful benefit to acknowledge service people for their time that they'd serve their country. Unfortunately, in many cases, the benefit cannot be used because of the cost. This change would help alleviate the problem. The time buyback would be more affordable, and as a result, more veterans would be able to use the benefit, and it would give them the choice of when to retire. On a personal note, in 2003, I realized I couldn't afford to buy back my time. And at that time, I couldn't do anything about it. So I've waited 2 years to come before you to make this request that you might change the law. And I'm hoping that it would keep other veterans from having that same disappointment of thinking, here I am ready to retire, but I can't afford it, and thinking I had a benefit that I can't use. So I guess I'm asking for your support on behalf of all veterans. And that's really all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. It's my pleasure to be here with my constituent, Elizabeth, who brought this issue to my attention, almost 2 years ago, wasn't it? Shortly after the reforms were signed into law and the issue sort of evolved as to how this would really play out and how it would affect our constituents. It seemed to me that she brought forward a very reasonable request that our veterans have an opportunity to buy back at a more reasonable cost. The years that have transpired since we have done this have been certainly very kind of hers, as the returns have been outstanding, shall we say. And what that means is this bill doesn't cost us any money, which is, of course, the best thing about it. So we sort of get the best world as representatives in that we can do something that is right, in my opinion, allowing veterans to make a choice to either buy back a higher monthly benefit, which would cost them a lot more money, or accept a lower benefit, which would cost them less money to buy back into. And the best part is, it's not going to cost the state anything. And I want to, you have my small summary sheet in front of you, just basically what this bill does. I want to thank Steve Delaney from PERS for working with us very diligently on this. He's made it certainly easy. This is not an easy issue to understand, and I'm not sure that I still fully understand it. I do trust Steve, and Steve has assured me that this is a very reasonable direction, and I think it'll certainly benefit Elizabeth and so many other veterans that are serving in the state. And I would ask your eye vote.
Thank you, Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, you indicated here, request that the emergency clause be added. Would that require an amendment or simply an act of the chair?
It's not in the bill.
It's not in the bill.
It would take an amendment. Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Kitts, that is correct. That will take an amendment to accomplish that. And perhaps anything else that either Steve Delaney or the committee would have their pleasure at in terms of amendments, I'd be happy to do those.
As time is running short in this session, hopefully, maybe, I hate to suggest this, but send it on and have it amended on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm perfectly fine with that. An emergency clause is a fairly simple thing to accomplish, in my view, and I would be more than happy to do that.
Mr. Chair, I just want to suggest it, but really all we have to do is add the words "and declare an emergency." Isn't that correct, or do we? Is it more language than that?
Well, there's language within the bill that states 90 days, okay. So you'd have to start deleting lines out.
Okay, sorry, just trying to help.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Legislative Council, as you know, is pretty fussy about, and justifiably so, about making conceptual amendments in committee. I wouldn't recommend that. I think the chair's got a great idea. It'd be wonderful if you pass the bill out, and we'll fix it on the Senate side.
That's almost an oxymoron.
No comment.
Is there any questions? Steve, do you want to add any comments?
I'm available to answer questions.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 3262? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3262 and open a work session on House Bill 3262. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3262 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3262 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Schlosser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Elizabeth for bringing this to us and the representative. Thank you for your service, not just to the state, but this country. We can help out other veterans in this situation as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any others? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Colby. Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Aye.
Representative
Schlosser. Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move 3260 to be placed in the consent calendar since it's going to be amended on the Senate anyway.
Representative Kitts moves we had that 3262 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it is. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2294. And Janet, can you give us a summary of 3294?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3294 has been before the committee on March 30th, had a hearing.
2294,
excuse me. All right. And, Mr. Chair, the question at that time was the support of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, MLAC, and this bill has been before the Management Labor Advisory Committee and supported it. It's also supported by the State Bar Workers' Compensation Committee that is composed of attorneys who represent workers, insurers, and self-insured employees. It specifies that a claimant may request a hearing before the Workers' Compensation Board if the Workers' Compensation insurer denies a claim for a new medical condition or an admitted medical condition, regardless of whether the claimant's five-year aggravation rights have expired. It also specifies that if the request is made after the 5 years and the condition is considered compensable, the claim is processed under the Board's rules for own motion claims. It provides a right of any party to appeal an award or order made by the board on the board's own motion. Mr. Chair, some changes were made in 2001 that, according to some of the attorneys, made litigation and appeals more difficult. And this would bring things back to make sure that there's the appeal process is in statute. And and limit some of the ability of the Workers' Compensation Board to limit these. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet.
And there's representatives of the Workers' Compensation Board here if you have any questions, and from the State Bar.
Is there anyone here that wants to testify on 2294?
Anybody that doesn't want it.
Anybody don't want it.
Is this the one that AMLAC didn't want to take up?
No, they did approve it.
They did.
Thank
you.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2294 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2294 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Kitts. Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move 2294 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2294 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so done. In committee, the next bills, 3435, 3436, 3437, and 3092 are all referrals to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And my recommendation, and I believe the committee's, was to be sent on their way there without recommendation. Janet, can we do this all in one motion?
If there's no objection, if anyone wants to have a different vote on a different bill, vote yes on one and no on another. But it's without recommendation. The recommendation was to go without recommendation.
My understanding, if and when we ever see these bills again, that'll look a great deal different than what they are in our present form. Representative Holden.
Mr. Chair, I have no objection to that, but I do have reservations about House Bill 3022. Just concerning the occupational safety and health standards, providing five ombudsmen with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Excuse me, it's my understanding those services are already provided by Oregon OSHA. So I do have reservations, but since it goes to Ways and Means and we'll probably come back for us to vote on later, I'll reserve my right to vote no on it later. Thank you.
Thank you.
My feelings exactly as far as reserving my right.
Well, why don't we,
Mr. Chairman, I would just propose then, considering the two gentlemen have expressed the opposition, is that we just have two votes. Let's just move 34, 35, 34, 36, 34, 37 in one vote, and then just move 3022 in a second vote.
Mr. Chair, if may I clarify my position, I didn't express opposition to anything. I just want to reserve my right to examine what comes out of Ways and Means. That's all I'm doing. In fact, I think I am signed on to 3022.
Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, I didn't say the representative had opposition.
Yeah.
I said reservation.
Yeah, let's have the motion. They have two motions, and Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bills 34, 35, 34, 36, and 34, 37 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves that House Bill 34, 35, 34, 36, and 34, 37 to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Hawthorne. Aye.
Representative
Fields. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And now another motion for House Bill 3022.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3022 to the Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3022 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Holden.
Well, as previously stated, Mr. Chair, I do have opposition to this bill. So I don't know if it's appropriate for me to vote yes on it when I know I'm going to vote no. So.
Representative Schaffler.
I have nothing to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
Katie, will you please call the room? Please call the room.
Representative
Hill. Aye.
Representative
Esposito. Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye. Representative Colby.
No.
Representative
Hill. Aye.
Representative
Schaffler. Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Janet, is there anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, it looks like, except for some extraordinary effort on Representative Schaffler's part to be here next Tuesday night, not tomorrow night, but a week from Tuesday works for people to have an evening meeting, and that will be a number of the prevailing wage bills for hearing.
And 4 to 6.
4 o'clock. 4 o'clock on a week from Tuesday, and we'll get notice around to your offices.
So what time would it start? 4, you said?
4 o'clock.
4. And ended at 6. Yeah. By 6.
Is that a pledge, Mr. Chair, that
yes,
we'll end at 6?
He'll have a motion to adjourn.
Wednesday and Thursday, there's no Ways and Means scheduled in my committee, and if that's the case next Tuesday, it'll be easy because I'll be able to drive home and get my little girl back. But I'll arrange something.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Call the babysitter.
And with that, we are adjourned. And there isn't anybody left.
Well.